Hey everyone, I wanted to take a moment of your time to let you know we have finally upgraded our website, www.theguiltpodcast.com. It now features a lot more information and is just in general much more useful and looks better. Make sure you get over there and sign up to our new email newsletter, which will be going up free and will keep you updated on the podcast and the cases as they move forward. And the fancy new website design is courtesy of our friends over at Medio Street Media, who are ready to help take your business to the next level. See, there are countless ways to market your business online, and yeah, that can be overwhelming. But it's not about doing everything, it's about doing the right things. At Medio Street, they take what's often seen as black magic and make it practical, with custom marketing plans driving leads for businesses in any industry, with any budget. You can check out their toolbox, including web design, social media marketing, SEM, SEO, video production, and more at mediostreet.com. Conversations are always free, so reach out today to get started. That's mediostreet.com, M-E-D-I-O, street.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
On the last episode of Guilt.
Roughly another minute or two, she turned around, wave, I say she said help, right where that power pole is. The car swerved violently off the road, right on that bend, violently. Like, I'd swear she'd either reached over and grabbed it, or he'd turned around and saw her waving, and he tried to grab her. Then he got up from digging the hole, then he stood there, pulling stuff out of a bag, throwing it into the water. He turned around and he headed up through the bushes. He walked up through the bushes.
And he would just search for years, walking all the tracks, going off the tracks. It can just consume them.
I was the last one that probably ever saw them alive, and I've never told anybody.
They've obviously been digging, and I've just pulled a bone out. There's a piece of bone right here. From Brevity Studios, I'm Ryan Wolfe, and this is Guilt. I'll always look for any avenue that can bring extra attention to this or my other cases, in the hope that someone might come forward with that pivotal new piece of evidence. One thing I often get told is that if there was a reward offered, it might draw these people out. Recently, I decided to try and raise a $10,000 reward via a New Zealand-based crowdfunding site called GiveItLittle. In 13 days, we'd managed to raise over $6,000 and looked like we'd easily raise the $10,000. But sadly, GiveItLittle made the decision that offering a reward of this type was in breach of their rules. So the donation page was removed and the funds were refunded to their donors. So instead, I've decided to put up the entire $10,000 myself. I've drained my bank account and transferred the money to a lawyer who has placed it in a special account where it will be held for a month, or as long as I can afford it to sit there. To claim the reward, you'll need to provide information that leads to the discovery of Heidi's remains. You can remain anonymous if you wish, but the location needs to be precise. You can contact me by emailing brevitystudiosnz@gmail.com. You can remain anonymous by simply creating a new Gmail account to send the email. Remember, the purpose of this is not to ascertain anyone's guilt, but simply to find Heidi. I know, $10,000 is not a huge amount of money. It's simply a bonus for the person who comes forward and does the right thing. In the last episode, we heard an amazing story from Joe in an experience he had in Furutau Beach as an 11-year-old, where he says he saw a man with a blonde girl driving erratically in a white station wagon before seeing him dig a large hole in the sand. I'll admit that from the first time I heard this story, I was skeptical. Joe's level of detail felt extreme, and it seemed that a lot of what he was telling me fit quite nicely with details from a book written about this case, one that he admits he read. So for me and yourselves as listeners, you need to come to your own conclusion as to how credible his story is. Either it fits because it's the truth, or perhaps unintentionally, he's made his story fit the known facts of the case. As I said in the last episode, there are some serious considerations that need to be made when accepting this story. Joe's age at the time being only 11, the fact that he didn't recall the story till decades later, that it can't be corroborated by anyone, and of course, his own personal research into the case perhaps clouding the truth. For me, I remain skeptical of much of the detail. But due to his confidence in what he says he saw, I warranted that it was worth you hearing it. It's also important that I make a distinction here. Just because someone shares their story or experience in the podcast, it doesn't necessarily mean I believe it to be true. It just means that I think it's worth sharing. You should consider the podcast like a courtroom. I'm the judge who presides over the case. I'm impartial. I simply provide the evidence, hopefully in a somewhat cohesive way. You are the jury, forming your own conclusion. Naturally, I have my own opinions about the case and what's taken place, and whose evidence I trust and believe. But I generally don't share this opinion unless I have further evidence, sometimes not included in the podcast, to corroborate it. The reason I'm saying this is not that I'm saying Joe's story is untrue, but what I'm not saying is I believe 100% that it is either. And it's important to remember that with all witnesses you hear. I included Joe's story mainly because of another witness statement that connects Furutau that you'll hear in the next episode. I'll add that since Joe's episode was released, I've been contacted by one of his family members who believes that Joe likely did see something and probably was chased by someone, but they're skeptical about many of the details he's provided, and they don't believe it's connected to this case. But Joe remains adamant about what he saw. And herein lies the problem when investigating cases of this age and profile. Your memory is not a hard disk that neatly stores everything to be retrieved accurately at any moment, and you must always remain mindful of that fact. Naturally, though, any witness evidence that was given closer to the time of the event will always be more credible. And when it comes to witness evidence closer to the time, there really is one man who seems to be the key to this case, and the truth of what took place. His name is Donald Turner, affectionately known as Spud.
Hello, Carla.
Hi, yep. Just your hand, come in.
How are you?
Good.
Let's get my shoes. Hello. Nice to see you.
Nice to meet you. This is my son,
Quentin. Hey, Quentin, how are you? Nice to meet you. Awesome. Cool.
This is Carla Turner, Donald Turner's wife. When I arrive, there are boxes and household items piled up, as they're still unpacking after a recent move. With her is Quentin, Donald and Carla's son. We sit down in the lounge, and they're both super friendly, just like any other normal family. Although their family today is marred by the grief and shock of Donald's recent passing, only a couple months before I started this investigation this year. A moment of discovery that I can quite clearly remember.
I'm really sorry to hear about Donald. Like, I was...
Yeah.
Honestly, I mean, when I found that out, I almost cried myself.
Yeah, I could hear your upset in the podcast that I listened to. Yeah, he wasn't supposed to go, but yeah.
Yeah, it's obviously, you know, it's obviously sad, and it's funny that he, you know, Donald obviously seemed like, from everyone I've spoken to, that he was a really good man, you know, just a few bumps along the way, I guess, in the days. But
yeah,
and of course, as well, for me too, like, looking into this case, it was devastating thinking that so much probably, like, died with Donald, unfortunately, you know, the truth, maybe.
Because that is one thing that is known to me, is that he had a whole relationship. He had tried at periods through the time that I knew him to find somebody that would listen to him, and nobody would. Nobody would take him seriously. And that was right back from when I was visiting him when he was in jail in 92, 93.
Initially, if you'll recall, Carla had made the decision that she didn't want to speak about the case publicly. She didn't want to get involved. However, when she heard others speaking of her husband, Donald, in a negative light, she decided that because he's not here to defend himself, well, she needs to do that for him. And I can only admire that decision. Donald has sadly passed, so the next best thing we have is Carla. I ask her to take me all the way back to the start and how they met.
Yeah, okay, so why don't we go back there? So how did you end up meeting Donald, and how did that start? I mean, is it a good combo to have, or? You can leave out.
There's nothing bad about it. My brother was in jail. And my daughter was having her fifth birthday, and Don designed up a card for my brother to send to me for her. And then a mate of theirs was released, and he was a real paranoid guy. And so the boys sent their letters to him, because I knew him from school. They sent them to my place. And when Don sent his letter, he sent a letter to me to thank me for passing on the letters, and it was just such a crack-up letter. Like, there was just real emotion in it, and I just turned around to my brother and I says, hey, tell that dude if he wants a pen pal, I'm happy to write to him. And it started with writing for a couple of months, and then phone calls, and then visits.
What a cool story.
Yeah, and then, yeah. Here we are now, 30 years later, and four kids.
Yeah. So, well, that's cool, I guess. That was back in the days before internet forums and stuff. You hear pen pals.
Yeah, it was definitely before the internet.
I'm going to chuck this microphone on this chair, actually, so I can get this audio. That's really cool. So, I mean, and that's something that everyone always says, that Donald was, you know, really articulate.
It was amazing. Like, he could be saying something really intimate in his letters and that, and I'd be blushing as I'm reading the letters and that. It just, there was just so much feeling in the letters that came through, the way he wrote, like he talked.
Yeah, it was very distinct, the way he would talk and articulate things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Are there any sort of recordings of him at all?
Not on hand, no.
Okay.
Yeah.
No, I mean, in general, did he ever, like, get a cassette recorder and record any memoirs or anything like that?
No. I have some written stuff that he wrote, but that was writing. He was trying to basically put down his life at that stage, because everyone was saying to him, dude, you should write a book, you know, your life, Christ. So he sort of started. So what I've got is just the beginning years with Dave and all that.
Yeah.
I've got that written in his handwriting.
Yeah.
And, you know, the accusations that he's made against Dave. So, yeah.
Prior to his death, Donald had made accusations against David about events that took place during their childhood. It does not come within the scope of this podcast, but I have had these accusations confirmed by other family members. Needless to say, there was tension between the brothers from an early age.
It sort of seems that that started, the sort of, that darkness was a bit of a cloud that hung over from that point on.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think Don was in jail when Urban was found. And I think that's what triggered everything for him, was hearing about Urban, where they found him. Because as far as he was told, it was close to the batch. I'm not sure. For him, it was obviously too close for comfort, because it was at that point that he started talking to me and telling me what he felt had gone on at that point. And I just said to him, well, I says, if you really believe that and you've really got an issue with it, then it's your choice to do something about it.
Yeah.
And the next thing I know, I'm hearing that he had spoken to the police. Yeah. And he'd spoken to them while he was still in jail.
So that was why he was still in jail?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so when did he get out of jail?
94.
Okay, oh, so that was about mid, so he must have done that sort of mid-90s, that was about right.
Yeah.
I don't know when he made the statement.
Yeah.
Because the police won't give it to me.
Only a few days ago, I finally received a response about my Official Information Act request asking for Donald Turner's statement made to police. As expected, New Zealand Police refused to provide this, citing the fact the case is still ongoing, given Tamahere has an upcoming appeal scheduled. They advised me to reapply early to mid-2024. So the details of what's contained in that statement I won't be getting for some time. But needless to say, the moment I can get it, I will. As you can imagine, Carla is incredibly protective of Donald and what is said about him now that he's passed. And she's the first to admit that yes, Donald has done plenty of bad things in his life, but according to her, nowhere near as bad as is being made out.
Yeah.
You know, there's other stuff.
Because when Darren keeps saying, you know, he's done a big lag, it was 5 or 7 years, and I'm going, the whole time I'm sitting there going, no, it wasn't. It was only 3.5 years.
Yeah, I suppose that is the hard thing with time and, you know, everything.
I just feel so defensive for him. I just feel like now that he's passed, it's easier for them to try and throw this in his direction than accept it themselves, because when I spoke to James, it was the day after I think you'd rung me, and I rang James up, and I was just talking. I hadn't said anything about you or anything, and then he jumped in. He goes, so what do you reckon? And I went, what do you mean? He goes, oh, all this stuff with the Swedes and all that sort of thing. And I went, look, Jim, I says, I've known for 24 hours that this is going on. He goes, oh, he says, I've had a couple of weeks of knowing about this. And I sat there, I said to him, it's nice of the family to keep me in the loop. And he didn't say much. after that. But then he said, he goes, I wasn't there. He says, I wasn't even there. I says, oh. He goes, and Don was with me. We were down at Mangakino or something. He goes, and Don was with me. And I went, Jim, Don has admitted to being at the batch at that time. He doesn't, why are you trying to make an alibi for him? He doesn't want it. He's told that he was there, you know, all the way through. He's, you know, said that he was there. So I wasn't quite sure why James was so adamant that he needed to put Don with him.
It's interesting, yeah.
Yeah, because there was no need to protect.
No, Don had made that quite clear from the beginning.
Yeah.
It seems, well, just from what I can see of it, him and Christine have showed up somewhere and something's going on, but they haven't.
Yeah.
He obviously hasn't realised what's happening at that time.
Yeah.
And like you said, Ivan gets found and then he starts piecing the bits together.
I can remember him definitely. He never mentioned seeing them. He did mention the white car. I think he mentioned that he did drive it once. He had to go and do something. It was either something for Father or James. And back in those days, you know, Don did what he was told. We didn't. James would just clip him.
He was the youngest of the family, wasn't he?
He's the youngest, the smallest.
Yeah.
Yeah, he'd had a number of clips from Jim, so he didn't sort of...
Yeah.
Yeah. James sort of, from his young teen years, James was sort of put into the father figure with Don. And he watched how James treated people and treated women, and he went down that road to a certain extent, nowhere near as vicious as Jim. But once he went into jail, he did every course that he could get his hands on, and made a lot of, you know, realisations in his life at that point. And he, when he got out, I think he was trying to pass those thoughts and that he had picked up to James and that, and they just didn't want to know about it. You know, as far as they were concerned, he was just being an egg.
What did Donald end up going? Was it for robbing the chemist or something? Is that why he ended up going to
Yeah, it was a rest home or something. They had tied up a couple of nurses, and he had a chappie with him, and the chappie was getting a bit frisky on it, and Don just looked at him and said, don't even think about it. He says, you think anything like that? He says, I'll knock you out, tie you up, and leave you here. You know, that's the sort of person he was. He wasn't, you know, he didn't hurt for no reason. You know, he didn't hurt someone for no reason at all. As far as I'm concerned, he did have a big heart. God, the amount of times he got himself in trouble with me trying to help out other women and things like that. he was always trying to be somebody's knight in shining armour.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What would you say, you know, like he was like as a father, you know?
Growing up and kind of talking to a lot of people my age and stuff and hearing their stories really makes me realise how good I had it. Yeah, that's been one thing that has become really apparent. Because, you know, when you're growing up as a teenager, no one likes their dad and stuff. But, no, looking back on it, it's incredible how much I apply to my relationships. And, like, I'm a father as well to my own children that I've realised come directly from him.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, the things that he, you know, really taught me growing up.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, he was a great father.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hey, I think he's been so proud of Quinton and the fact that he feels that himself and Quinton, they've finally broken the cycle of abuse and that towards their partners and their children. Because for years, Don thought that, like, he was given away when he was little. Now, for years, he thought that the people that he was given to was a set of grandparents or something in South Auckland. I can't remember the name of the town that the people, well, I think it was a little community with a dam or something. I can't remember the name of the place. But these people weren't even related to him that Mother had given him away to. And I think Father was in jail at the time. And when he got out, he had to, Marina, go and get that boy. He had to make her go and get him. Whereas Don had this thought in his head that his father was the one that had made Marina give him away because he was darker than the rest of them. And, he thought, didn't think to say that Don was his. And that was Don's thinking. That's what he utterly and truly, truly believed until he found out the truth.
Whichever way you look at it, Spud faced a childhood set with difficulties you and I likely couldn't fathom. And it's no surprise that eventually he found a way to escape from that pain. Drugs.
And that's exactly where it came down to, was he realised that the drugs, they just took him to a different place, somewhere that wasn't. You know, it was, it was what it was. Like, I've used IV drugs, and the only reason I think I ever started was I had no understanding of why or what it was all about. So I initially tried it so I could understand Don more than anything. The need that he had, it was so intense. That monkey on his back was always going to be the thing that I would have to fight for Don. I didn't have to worry about him with women and things like that. It was just that bloody monkey.
Did Don ever get a full sort of control of it,
actually?
Or sort of just managing?
He was on methadone program. He had stopped living, you know, going out and doing scores and things like that. He didn't need to because he was on the Done. And I'm not saying that he used his Done the way you're supposed to, but he knew, you know, that was his, that's what he took, and he didn't seek anything else.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
When he passed, they said that he passed from multiple, what was it?
Multiple drug toxicity?
Yeah, multiple drug toxicity.
It's like a build-up or something.
Yeah, basically, because when we found him, you know, everybody thought, oh, he must have overdosed, you know. And when the police and the ambulance and that people arrived, I says, look, I says, here's his methadone. I says, here's the 3 days. I says, I picked up his because he couldn't get down there. I says, he's only drunk in half a day. I says, because there's 2.5 bottles here. I says, so he hasn't even had a full dose of his dome today.
Ultimately, Carla tells me that Donald didn't die of an overdose. Officially, it was multiple drug toxicity, which is more or less a long-term slow build-up of drugs in the system. But she says he was unable to get his usual dose of a prescribed medication in the week before his death, which she believes likely contributed to it. Despite his lifelong drug use, there's one recurring thing I always hear about Donald. He was an incredibly smart man, and his recall of facts or past events was legendary. If Donald said something, you could rely on it being the truth.
Jody Dando, and I was talking to her recently, she was saying that, you know, he'd call up every once in a while just seeing how the kids were and you know, just generally just being nice.
Yeah.
For no real reason. But no. She said, yeah, that was just Don. That's just what he did.
Yep. Yeah.
She, you know, she said to me too, that if he said something, like if he said Tommy he was there, then he was fucking there.
Yeah.
He wouldn't say it unless it was.
No, he was there. And that was the other thing. He says, under no circumstances am I saying that Dave Tamahiri is innocent. He says, I'm just saying that it was the two of them, not just him on his own.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And in that sentence lies the crux of Donald's whole story. David Tamahiri, he's not innocent. He was there with his brother David. And whatever took place, the two of them were involved. It's very important to note that anything Carla says regarding what Donald saw on the farm is hearsay. I've mentioned this before, that it doesn't mean it's not true. But what it does mean is that it's not direct from the source, as obviously Donald has passed. At the end of the day, Carla says she wasn't there. But this is simply what Donald told her happened, and she knows he would want her to pass this on.
So when you you were pen-palling with Donald.
Yep.
And then so, you know, just to go back to this weed thing, did he sort of start mentioning it to you in the letters or something?
No. When I started visiting him, I think he sort of started, like he mentioned to me, like I think it was around the time where Evan's body was found. Can you remember, do you know what year that was?
91, it was October of 91.
91, yep, because I started probably visiting him beginning of 92.
Oh, yeah, so it would have been right at that time.
So, yeah, so he would have probably had that right in his head, and I just became the person he obviously could talk to. I think it was the sheer fact that wasn't connected to his family. I wasn't connected to all of his mates and that. So anything he said to me, I didn't have anyone that I could go and say it to that would cause any hassle for him. Because, you know, he kept saying he was after security and stability in his life. It was almost, at the beginning, he was almost very desperate to find out what was going on, what had happened, what the hell went down. And that's why, and I really hope Darren, if he's listening to this, takes this to heart, that Don never ever sought him out to try and intimidate or anything like that. He just wanted to know the information that he's given out now, because he was, what, you know, what happened? He didn't know what had completely happened. All he knew was he was in jail at that time, and they'd found the body of one of the Swedes at the batch. And he stuck in there, couldn't talk to anybody that knew anything. So when we got out, we came running to Darren and his missus at the time. And we spent a lot of time at their place, and the boys went fishing and all that sort of thing. So Darren obviously realised pretty quick that Don wasn't out to cause him any harm whatsoever. You know, Don liked Oldie. So it's a bummer that Oldie would think that Don would want to cause him any harm, because it wasn't. He just wanted to know what the hell happened there.
Carla refers to Darren Old as Oldie here. And if you'll remember back to his interview, he said that after Donald got out of prison, he came and found Darren and was telling him about how his brother Dave had been involved in the murders of Heidi and her barn. Darren told me at the time he believed Donald was fishing for information, to see what Darren knew, perhaps to tie up loose ends. Well, according to Carla, she was there and says that yes, Donald was fishing for information, but only because he wanted to know what happened with the case while he was in prison. Remember, in these days before the internet, tracking down information wasn't so easy. According to Carla, Donald freely admitted that yes, he was there, but at the time, he wasn't aware of what was taking place. It wasn't until he was in prison in 1991 and Urban's body was found at the back of the farm that everything clicked.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Like, yeah. Well, as I say, Don admits that he did drive that white car.
Sure he did,
It was supposed to be, he had drove it into town or something to get something. I can't quite remember. But I know that they weren't at the batch for very long, if anything, just overnight. He said that Christine woke up during the night and found Dave standing at the end of the bed. But Don said she woke him up once he, you know, moved away and told him what had happened with Dave, and that they packed up basically first thing the next morning and were out of there.
But, you know, so I suppose, but, so Donald, though, he never meant, so like you said, he never said James was there, never said James was involved.
Yeah.
You think he probably would have told you that if he felt that was the, he told you everything he knew.
Yeah. I think so. Well.
Did you ever have a thought that Donald could have had maybe some involvement?
No. But he may have seen a lot more than he told me. I don't know. Because I feel like we had talked about it so many times, and it was always the same. You know, it never changed. It never wavered, which made me think that this is the truth, because, you know, these conversations were taking part, you know, a couple of years apart. You know, we wouldn't talk about it, then he'd talk about it again, or, you know, something would bring it up in his mind, or he'd see something and he'd talk about it again, and it was always still.
Yeah. What was it that he would say? So him and Christine would show up and...
Yeah, him and Christine turned up there and they needed somewhere to crash, as far as I'm concerned. I know that it obviously was early enough for him to take the car and do whatever he was asked to do. And then he brought the car back, so I think he just went into town or something and came back, sort of thing. And then it doesn't say much more about what happened. Dave turned up And he said he wasn't happy being there with Dave there. And he had his mate with him. And yeah, well, I presume that was Tamahiri, yeah. Because that was the thing with Don. He said, I can remember him saying, he says, for fuck, he says, the two of them could have been fucking twins. He says, they look so much alike. And when you do put the photos together of the two of them at that time period, it's like, Jesus Christ. Because they both scruffy hair, but handlebar moustache. You know, they weren't skinny men or anything like that. Whereas, you know, Don was, you know, 5'7". You'd be lucky if he was 70 kilos, you know. He didn't eat, he did drugs. So, yeah. He didn't look like any of them. But as he says, his main thing to me was, he said, under no circumstances am I saying that Dave Tamahiri is innocent. I'm just saying that Dave Turner was involved in it with him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So then he sees them, they're hanging out, obviously driving the car.
Yeah.
But then is there any other, did he say anything else other than that?
No.
And then Dave, Christine and him have left the next morning or something.
Yeah, so yeah,
he's obviously realised in prison.
You need that statement because I believe that if there's anything he hasn't said to me, it'll be on that statement.
Yeah, it's really interesting to me actually. That just saying, if Donald was there and saw Tamahiri and Turner there, and they had the Swede's car,
yeah,
that gives me quite a good time frame because I know that car, you know. That had to have shown up. I mean, unless the switch happened and the cars were switched, I don't really know.
But yeah.
I'm starting to think maybe.
He never said anything about doing that. No, he just said that he had to drive the car into town and back.
So I don't, yeah.
But he didn't realise whose car he was actually even driving at the time.
And I mean, if they were driving one car around, well, it can't be the same car that was parked up the hill for a couple of days. So it makes sense that. James said he never saw that white Subaru again either.
Yeah.
So I wonder if the story is true about the car getting buried, then I think it would have been father's one that was buried and not the Swede's one.
Yeah.
Probably was no switch.
Yeah.
But what it does mean, though, is if Heidi wasn't there when Donald turned up and he saw them both in the car, well, then it, you know,
yeah.
It must have happened quite quickly. And
yeah, because I can't remember whether he said something. My memory's not 100% on whether he said he saw Urban or not. For some reason,
that would be huge if we knew that.
For some reason, that's sitting in my head that Don had said he saw Urban there. It's a matter of where would... You know, they didn't go that far with Urban, so...
What's interesting now,
The hell did they go with Heidi?
Well, that's the thing. So, like, that's why for me now, like, just that little piece, like, fuck if I could get hold of that statement, but that little piece is real. If Donald saw the car there with the bull bars, and
yeah.
James did too, and if we believe them both and say, okay, they didn't see Heidi in her barn,
yeah,
that means they had to be dead already by that point.
Yeah.
That means it's a short time frame, and so that means that probably couldn't have taken her far.
Yeah.
She's either in for it.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Nearby.
Yeah, because that was the thing he said, you know. I wish I could remember 100% whether he saw. I have this, like, part memory thing of him saying that he saw Urban, a young chap, long sandy beach blonde hair or something. He said, was just sitting under a tree. He said he just had his head down, wasn't doing anything, it was just sitting there.
Okay. Fuck, if that was true, that would be interesting.
Because Urban's not going to try and make a run for it and leave Heidi behind.
No. Yeah, but that's interesting, you know, that thing about if Donald did drive the car and he saw it there, then the window of time...
He definitely said he drove the car.
Mm. Yeah, that's interesting. That means that there, that window of time, he never saw Heidi,
But I just seem to have this memory that he said he saw this guy sitting under one of the trees. So
it wasn't. So he said he was alive, eh? Didn't
yeah.
Didn't say he was dead.
No.
Because he would have done. See.
He would have freaked out on that.
Yeah.
No. That's not Don's style at all. He would have nothing to do with that sort of, you know, with rape and murder and that. That is not him at all. He would have, I think if he's looking down, he'll be happy that questions are being answered finally. You know, people, not answered, but asked, because it was one of those things that was forever in the back of his head, that he felt that, you know, something that he knew his brother had done what he'd done, and nobody would listen to him. That must be just so, must really scramble your head a bit when you know something like that has happened and nobody will listen to you.
There's a fair bit to process in this episode, and there are some important things to note. Remember, like I said, this is hearsay. It's simply what Carla can recall Donald telling her over the years. And by her own admission, she's a bit hazy on some of the details. But there are a couple things she is 100% certain Donald told her. Firstly, Tamahedi was present on the farm, and that he was in the company of David Turner. That they were driving a vehicle that Donald came to believe was the Swede's car, and that Donald himself had in fact driven the car into town running an errand for someone. And some of this should come as no surprise. Remember that David Turner confirmed Heidi and Oban were on the property. He also said Tamahedi was there, and appeared to imply that he was present also. James Turner also stated that he had seen the car with bull bars on the property, and we've come to believe this must have been the Swedes. He also said his father told him that Tamahedi had sold his brother David a set of bull bars, which again connects him to the property. What we can't say right now is what happened next. Remember, just because David Turner was present with Tamahedi, it doesn't necessarily make him guilty of murder. And the same goes for Tamahedi. Clearly, Donald Turner believed it to be the case that they were both involved, but ultimately, according to Carla, Donald wasn't present when whatever happened, happened. But of course, we have Darren Old's statement that he saw Heidi being led by David Turner, while James stood over Urban and Donald was changing license plates on two white station wagons. We now know Donald was definitely there, and we can safely say that David was too. But as yet, no one has corroborated James's presence. The final tantalizing possibility is Carla possibly recalling Donald saying he saw Urban sitting under a tree. If this were true, it would place Donald there at the same time as Urban, and more than likely Heidi also. But like Carla said, her memory of that point is hazy, so she could be wrong. Like she said, I need that statement he made to police. That will likely contain all the missing details. When considering Donald's possible involvement in this case, Carla admits there could be things that he's not told her. But if Donald was involved in Heidi and Urban's murders, why would he spend the rest of his life trying to tell this story? There's a consistent theme to everything I've ever heard about Donald. Yes, he was a junkie. Yes, he treated some of his girlfriends poorly in the past. But rape and murder, not a chance. While in prison, Donald turned his life around. And on his release, he packed up his new family and moved far away. His goal was to break the cycle of abuse. And I can see in the evidence of his family today that he was 100% successful in that goal, and left behind a wife and children that remember him only as a kind, caring, funny man, albeit with that one monkey on his back that he learned to manage, but sadly could never remove. Donald always had a complicated relationship with his father, and I was told by James that at Donald's wedding, their father, after seeing the new life Donald had created, shook his hand and told him, "Well done. You did it, son." If Donald's account of what he saw is true, then it means certain people are withholding the truth about what took place in April of 1989. And it would seem to confirm that Tamahedi's story about never meeting Heidi and her barn is a lie. And it seems that lies, half-truths, and deceit have riddled this story like a cancer in the history of this case. With every party seemingly protecting themselves, someone else, or their own personal interests. However, it's beginning to feel like the final pieces are falling into place. I believe I'm going to find the how and the why. But what about the most important question of all? Where? Where is Heidi? To those out there listening to this right now, that genuinely hold that truth, it's time to come forward and do the right thing. Come forward and claim the reward. But more importantly, be that person. The one that sent Heidi home. Guilt is a Brevity Studios production, written, produced, and narrated by me, Ryan Wolfe. All opinions expressed in this podcast are exactly that, opinions, and are not a statement of fact by the podcast itself. All persons named are presumed innocent unless proven otherwise in a court of law. You'll find further photos and video on my Instagram, RyanWolfeNZ. Guilt is a 100% independent production. We've never received a single dollar in taxpayer funding, and you can support us to continue to make great content, plus get ad-free listening, bonus episodes, and early release by becoming a Brevity Plus subscriber on Apple or Acast Plus. You'll find the details in the show notes of every episode. This podcast was written and edited without the use of AI.